We're under the covers on Afternoons.
You're a woman, you want social themes, believable characters. You want plot suspense.
The strange story of the flowers had never been reported in the press.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Come, we shall walk together.
I can honestly say it's one of the most enjoyable periods of my life.
Under the covers. There's something in the landscape in Australia that lends itself to the epic novel. It's a no-brainer, really, that vastness, the extremes of hot and cold, the potential for silence and solitude in the wilderness, that harsh beauty, and the very real danger that if you're not prepared for the outback, it just might kill you. In short, it's a fairly stunning backdrop for a good old-fashioned ripper yarn. Peter Watt is a writer whose books I think will probably be quite familiar to you. They're so like that epic view of Australia. His historically based adventure fiction is set within sweeping landscapes, that sense of living on the frontier. And Peter is our guest today on Under the Covers. It's wonderful to have you with us, Peter.
It's wonderful to be here in a state that actually has those sweeping landscapes.
Oh, my goodness, we do indeed. Where did you grow up? Where were you born?
I was actually born in Sydney, but I grew up on a soldier settler block in western New South Wales. And, of course, soldier settler blocks is a term that we don't sort of think about today. But after World War I and World War II, soldiers returning from the war were given land by the government. And, of course, the government was fairly cheap at the time. It always gave them bad land. They had to first clear it. Most of them weren't farmers. And in my case, I was lucky my dad had some background in farming. So for me, in the 1950s growing up, it was a case of learning the smell of diesel and dust as you drove the tractor at the age of seven.
And what role did books have, your earliest memories of reading? Were your mum and dad big readers?
My dad wasn't a reader, but my mum was. A highly intelligent lady who actually, during World War II, was offered a job by the Packer Group as a journalist, but she gave that up to go into the Air Force as a codes cipher specialist. So I had the influence of my mum as a reader. But growing up in a place called Warrawidgee, which is west of Griffith in New South Wales, there were no radios, no electricity. There was just nothing. And I know that's bad grammar. But anyway, the whole thing is...
You're in good company here.
And the whole thing was that we did have access to books, and as a kid I was reading all those horrible penny dime type westerns, American westerns and comics, you know, and so I was exposed to the written word very early in my life, so I was forced to learn how to read, and of course by the age of 10 I was actually reading John Steinbeck and didn't understand it, but it was great prose.
Now you're looking at your early career progression, soldier, articled clerk, prawn trawler deckhand. There wasn't much of a clue from that you were going to be an author, and they're very action jobs, perhaps except for the clerk work. But when did you know you wanted to become a writer?
I think, and a few of my old classmates have pointed out, that even back in primary school I was writing stories and didn't think much about that. But I think we've got this gene that drives us to write, to relate to the world in words. And I'm hoping one day scientists can actually isolate that gene and maybe save future generations of people like me from this terrible urge to write. So that will be one of the great steps in science, I hope, in the future.
Now, there's so much action in your writing. Who were you first reading when you realised that you can do this, that you can have wars and explosions and these massive adventures without the pictures?
I think probably the author that first influenced me was that great author James A. Michener.
Love him.
So do I. And of course, somebody said to me once, if you had to identify just one book, isolate one book that really influenced your whole life as a writer, it would have to be James A. Michener's book, The Source. And of course, that book was basically about the rise of the three great religions in the West, but told in a style, a wonderful, exciting style, where it made you imagine being back in the Holy Land maybe 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. So James A. Michener was able to do that to me. He took me back 5,000 years. And by revealing on the archaeological site that he set his book, I started to understand maybe the spirituality of all of us in the world through his one book, The Source.
He's an incredible writer, and I can see where your own sense of that vast sort of frontier and tracking, because that's one of the things he does so well, isn't it? He'll take a particular point and then track from there, which you have done as well in your work. You've also said that you're completely unashamed about borrowing from Wilbur Smith in the past. And he's obviously been a huge influence on you. Have you ever been able to thank him?
I have. As a matter of fact, about 6 years ago, Wilbur Smith was on tour in Australia, and because we write for the same publishing firm in Australia, I was actually introduced to him. And I was in awe of this wonderful, charming man. He has a charisma. And, of course, he was surrounded by literally 1,000 people at this function he was attending. So he walked over to me and he said to me, I know you. And I was only just 3 books out on the market. And I said, how do you know me? He said, because every damned airport I get off around the world, your books are there. So it was nice to be acknowledged by this great man. I unashamedly borrowed his formula because he, reading his books as a young man, he told us about Africa, about its culture, its politics. And long before most people knew the name Nelson Mandela, Wilbur Smith readers knew about him, even though he may have been thinly disguised, and his work he was doing. And so he not only entertained, but he educated. And in a sense, I'm a mass market author, as they call them, not a literary writer. So we still were able to justify our writing by saying, well, we can sometimes unconsciously tell people about history without them even understanding that they're learning. So Wilbur Smith came across and he said that. But being a cheeky Aussie, I said to him during dinner, when we were having dinner, I said, mate, you stick with Africa, the Middle East and Europe. Don't cross the Indian Ocean. I'll look after Australia, Southeast Asia and the Pacific. But I feel bad because a few times in my books I've crept back into Africa because Australians have been in Africa in historical times.
He hasn't caught you out for
it. No. And I'm even proud to say that occasionally I get letters from readers from overseas in Australia saying, since I've read a Peter Watt book, I might give Wilbur Smith a try. I immediately send him those emails to know that he will know he's got another reader.
Under the Covers on Afternoons.
Author Peter Watt is our guest on Under the Covers. We're talking books. And interesting that you use the word justified. Do you feel, because you're a mass market author, but people read your books, why do you feel that there's a justification needed?
There is. You know, I've been to one or two writers' festivals, and the mass market authors, a lot of them are my good mates, male and female, gather in one corner, and then the literary writers gather in another corner, and the media only pays attention to the literary writers. And so there is this kind of division amongst writers, even at writers' festivals.
That's really odd. So I bet you sell more books, though.
We do. As a matter of fact, my own publishing firm, when I first met my wonderful publisher, Kate Patterson, many years ago, and she had this sort of strained look on her face. This was our first meeting, and she said to me, now you've got your first book out, you know, do you have any intentions of going for any of those literary awards? And I thought about it and said, no, I just want to write books that people want to read. And then, of course, she had this wonderful, relaxed look on her face saying, thank God.
And I think because looking at your work, and you do Australia historically so well, and it's obviously researched, and I think with any sort of historical fiction, you have to be able to do that. You have to research it. So I'm thinking, you know, the Philippa Gregorys and the Hilary Mantel, who's just won the Booker Prize twice, and that historical genre is so important. Why did you choose Australia, and how important is that research to you?
I chose Australia, and for those who have read my books know they've set more against the northern part of Australia. I was actually a student of Professor Michael Rowe in Tasmania back in the 70s when I studied Australian history. And I noticed that all the Australian history we studied was all set down south. You know, it was Van Diemen's Land or Botany Bay. And I thought, well, what about the rest of Australia in the same period of time? So I went in search of material and found, wow, we had a frontier, not dissimilar to that of the American West and even of that of Africa. And it had never been written about. So I thought, this is a great canvas, you know, to paint pictures on, because it is that, as you explained in your intro, the death was there at all times. So I said, right, that's my canvas. It'll be the frontier. So there were no convicts and no Ned Kellys and bushrangers. Well, kind of a bushranger. So I set out and started my series of stories in the McIntosh Duffy saga against that canvas. And it's been successful because the Americans, when they read the books, contact me and they say, we didn't know you had a frontier. We thought you were all convicts. So it's changing even their perception of this country. And I'm pleased to say, often I have Americans contact me saying, instead of going to Europe, we're going to Australia for our holidays. So to corroborate this is happening, I take photos of them when they arrive. We usually meet the parties. So I know I'll never win a literary award. I'm hanging out for the Queensland Tourist Bureau Award.
They should make you their ambassador. And you write Indigenous characters into your books. In the era that you write about in your early books, The Cry of the Curlew, Aboriginal people were treated very badly. Mm. And certainly in the area that your books cover in rural Queensland, there were massacres, there are a lot of atrocities that perhaps haven't been written into popular fiction. How do you reflect on that?
That's an interesting point. A lot of my, because I worked up in the Gulf of Carpentaria for about 4 years. Mm. We'd spent 6 months of the year and living in places like Doomadgee, Kawanyama, Arakoon. So I got to know the Indigenous people up there very well. And even now, some of them contact me and say, oh, you know, mate, it's great you're telling the white fellas about our history, you know, about the terrible things that happened in the front on the frontier. But I say to them, I'm not moralising. I'm just simply telling a story. You know, I'll let the reader make up their mind on what happened. But it has, particularly in my first book, Cry of the Curlew, I had a lot of people say, I couldn't even get through the first five chapters. It was so confronting. And I just tell them all, you know, skip the first five chapters and go to chapter six.
Oh, but sometimes you need to be confronted.
And it's kind of interesting, too, that so many Australians have written to me and said, we didn't know this happened. No wonder they got a bit of anger. So I don't take sides. I'm not on the white fella's side. I'm not on the black fella's side. I'm just a storyteller. But it is nice if some people can sort of sit back and reflect on, okay, maybe those people that we condemn do have something to sort of be angry about. Let's look at what happened in the past.
How much of that story is there left untold? Your latest book, Beyond the Horizon, this is the seventh book?
In that saga, yes. Yeah. Well, I've already written the book that follows that for release next year because now my life has changed dramatically. I spend 5 months of the year, almost every day, fighting bushfires. And since August, through August and September, it was a case of every day, 12 hours a day virtually, out fighting fires in northern New South Wales. So it's funny now, I'm going to have to cram writing in between bushfire periods. And that sort of brings me to the point too that, you know, some of the wonderful heroes that we have in our communities, and I saw it sadly here in WA, those two ladies badly burned, and yet we put so much emphasis on highlighting sports stars or movie stars and calling them even heroes, when real heroes are just men and women, you know, employed, unemployed, ranging in age from 20 to 70, and they don't get the same kind of recognition as all these media stars.
Do you think that you might write some of those heroes into some of your future stories?
I didn't think I would, but the more I've been out on the fire line fighting fires, the more I've come to appreciate what these people face every year and don't even sort of consider themselves as heroes, and they are.
Under the Covers on Afternoons.
Peter Watt is our guest on Afternoons. We're talking books in Under the Covers. Now, which Australian writers do you like to read, aside from yourself?
Well, I can actually now give my mate Tony Park a plug here, and I'll warn any people who read Tony Park's books that he is a bad man, because every time he turns up at my place, I have to go to casualty to have my liver drained out. Tony and I share some common experiences. We're both former soldiers. Tony was a major, served as PR officer for the SAS in Afghanistan. He's a few years younger than I am. Of course, my period of time was during the Vietnam War in 69 to 72. So we have a lot in common. But Tony's rather unique. He's an Aussie, but he lives a lot of his time in Africa, and he takes tours in Africa and writes about Africa, like Wilbur Smith. I would say to people, if you look for Peter Watt's twin brother, but writing about the other side of the world, you'd go and get a Tony Park book, because they are wonderful, exciting books.
I've got a few quick questions for you to ask before we finish off. Is there a book or a writer that's been a constant companion for you, one that you keep coming back to?
This is a difficult question for any writer, because we read so much and we have so many authors that we love. But strangely enough, there was one author, he's a foreign author, a man called Bernard Cornwell, who writes similar sort of stories to us who write faction. And, of course, I asked Wilbur Smith, who's your favourite author? And he said Bernard Cornwell. So we do have this common tree, or it's like a tree that has these authors on it. So Bernard Cornwell's probably a great influence on my writing too.
Is there a book you wish you'd never read?
Oh, yes, quite a few of those. To protect the authors, I'm not going to even mention what they are and who they are. Some of them actually had the word literary before them.
Okay.
I remember Wilbur said to me once, he said, somebody said to me, these are the top 10 books shortlisted for some literary prize. He said, that's definitely 10 books I'm not going to read.
You're very involved in Get Reading these days, and you are the ambassador for October.
Yes.
In particular. Can I ask if there is a book, if you could, add it to the high school curriculum for every Australian child to read? What would that be?
If we were adding a book to the Australian curriculum, I would like to think it was one based against our unknown history. As a matter of fact, I've actually had a few high school teachers talk to me and say, with your books, the way you write them, there's no bad language, no really truly graphic scenes. So some of my books could possibly be added. And a good thriller, of course, is The Frozen Circle. But what has come out, my book, The Silent Frontier, set against the Maori Wars in New Zealand, where the Australians fought. Of course, the first character we meet is a young boy, 10, and we see his life progress. And a few high school students have said to me, we love that book. And I was proud to think to myself that there's no bad language, nothing offensive, it's just a good rollicking action adventure. But it took those young readers through from the dust of the summer's day in 1854 at Ballarat with the Eureka Stockade into the jungles of, you know, the northern part of Australia via the battlefields of New Zealand. So it was a great, I think, a good book that could be put on high school curriculums. First and foremost, to get people reading, they've got to actually enjoy what they're doing. Mm. And so I've even heard people condemn comic books. And I grew up in comic books because at least it encouraged me to read. So I think anything, comic books, even those terrible, dreadful westerns that I read actually gave me a love for reading. So yes, it must be the love first, then the learning can come later.
Is there a book that makes you laugh?
Oh, there's been a few. And I think, and I'm going to pay tribute to one of our great Australian writers, Robert G. Barrett. Now, when I mention that name here, I'm pretty sure there are quite a few men out there who would start smiling straight away. And I remember with Robert G. Barrett, who sadly passed away about 3 weeks ago, I'd read his books and I'd laugh out loud because he summed up the real ochre Australian. And, of course, he created that wonderful character who's now legendary. I almost said literature. That wonderful character, Les Norton, the big Queenslander, red-headed Queenslander who goes down to Sydney. So much reminiscent of that famous British show, Minder. So, to me, Robert G. Barrett, mate, we're going to miss you. A friend of mine who's a radio broadcaster in New South Wales is his best friend, and he said he and Robert G. Barrett worked as bouncers in Bondi in Sydney. And he said Robert could fight. But one of the things Robert hated was Johnny Farnham songs and red wine. So on John Carroll's show in New South Wales, he's played Johnny Farnham and raised a glass of red wine to him, just to spite him. So Robert G. Barrett, yes, mate, we're going to miss your books.
Is there a book that you have used to escape?
It was kind of funny. I was on the bus travelling to Kapuka in 1969, going into training when we knew that the inevitability might be that we'd be going to Vietnam after that, and we could get killed because we had high casualty rates then. And I'm reading Wilbur Smith's The Dark of the Sun. And strangely enough, this book, of course, was set against mercenaries in the Congo. It was actually a kind of a calming effect. So I guess in a sense, Wilbur's always been in my life from when I was very young through my military time, even up to till today.
Now, you've chosen a song to finish off with. What have you chosen? And tell us why.
It has to be that great Australian group that comes from my time when I was going to school in the 60s, the Easy Beats. Because if you listen to the Easy Beats when you were in school, you were a rebel. I mean, today we think they're pretty tame. But the great song that I thought that they had was Friday on My Mind, because that kind of sums up the feeling of a working week.